The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from the edition of The Week, dated December 16th, 2011. Now we'll turn to the main story section. The first article entitled, Fragile Signs of Economic Recovery, What Happened? The U.S. unemployment rate dipped to its lowest level in more than 2 years last month, according to a Labor Department report that showed both promise and peril for President Obama's reelection bid. Employers added 120,000 new jobs in November, helping to reduce the unemployment rate by 0.4 percentage points to 8.6%. Job gains for previous months were also revised up to 210,000 from 158,000 in September and to 100,000 from 80,000 in October. The president welcomed the figures as a sign that the economic recovery from the Great Recession was finally getting traction, saying that private sector employment had now been growing for nearly 21 months in a row. But the report also highlighted major weaknesses in the economy. Part of the reason the jobless rate fell so much was that about 315,000 people simply gave up looking for work and were no longer classified as unemployed. And even excluding the hundreds of thousands who left the labor force, the country still has more than 13 million registered jobless workers, whose average period of unemployment stands at a record high of 41 weeks. Those with jobs were also suffering as average hourly earnings fell 0.1% in November. Republicans said the report proved that Obama's response to the economic crisis had failed. The Obama administration promised unemployment would stay below 8% if its stimulus was enacted, said House Speaker John Boehner. That promise has gone unfulfilled. Now here's what the editorial said. Cross your fingers and knock on wood, said the New York Daily News. The economy may be coming back to life. As well as a fall in the headline unemployment rate, the number of long-term unemployed job seekers has dropped from 6.7 million in early 2010 to 5.7 million today. And temporary hires are on the rise, often a sign that more permanent jobs are in the offing. There are still dark clouds on the horizon, but at the moment the trends are moving in the right direction. There's little to celebrate, said the New York Times, just to replace all the jobs lost in the recession and keep up with population growth, the economy would need to add 275,000 jobs a month for the next 5 years. We're way off that goal. And the few jobs that have been created are mostly in low-paying sectors, such as retail sales. The only remedy for this dire situation is a strong government intervention to boost the economy. Yet Congress is tied in knots over even basic recovery measures, such as extending unemployment benefits or the payroll tax cut. Now here's what the columnist said. Merry Christmas, Mr. President, said Chris Sizliza in the Washington Post. For Obama to win re-election next year, he desperately needs some evidence that the economy is starting to move in the right direction. This report will help him win over wavering independents who may be less inclined to make a change at the top if unemployment is steadily dropping. Try telling that to the Democratic base, said Charlie Cook in National Journal. Unemployment among African Americans still stands at 15.5%. Among Hispanics, it's 11.4%. And for 18 to 19-year-olds, it's a whopping 23.6%. Those groups might have propelled Obama's 2008 victory, but the lack of hope and change in the economy could cause dispirited Democrats to stay home in 2012. When Obama is reduced to celebrating the fact that 315,000 people have given up on finding jobs, said Peter Wehner in CommentaryMagazine.com, You know the economy remains badly wounded. All the political spin in the world won't change that. True enough, but the real issue is why, said Zachary Carabel in the DailyBeast.com. Most of the manufacturing jobs that disappeared during the recession will never come back since they were made obsolete by globalization and new technologies. Democrats and Republicans should stop battling over tax cuts and hikes, which are pretty useless for job creation, and instead explain how they would lay the groundwork for a fundamentally restructured economy. That's what every recent jobs report tells us we need, but it's unlikely that's what we'll get. The next item from the Week magazine main story section from International News, Putin stung at the polls. Russian voters delivered a firm rebuke to Prime Minister Vladimir Putin in elections this week by stripping his United Russia party of 77 seats in the State Duma. Opposition parties said the losses were reduced the governing party share of parliamentary seats from 70% to 53%, would have been steeper if not for widespread vote rigging that benefited United Russia. Thousands of people, galvanized by amateur online videos showing apparent ballot box stuffing and illegal campaigning, took to the streets in Moscow in protest. Russian authorities responded by deploying thousands of security forces in Moscow and other cities and arresting hundreds of protesters. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said Russians deserve a full investigation of electoral fraud and manipulation, and former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev called for new elections. Even a rigged election can send a message, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Russian voters are tired of the criminality that has infected every corner of the Russian government. If the voting had been free and fair, there's no telling how far the ruling party might have fallen. There is still little doubt that Putin will win the Russian presidency in March. But this backlash is proof that his decision to retrench rather than reform his regime has provoked a Russian awakening. Putin boasts of bringing stability to Russia, but many Russians see only stagnation, said Stefan Wagstiel in the Financial Times. For years, Putin has bought popular affection by doling out government jobs and oil revenues with one hand, while curtailing rights and enriching his corrupt friends with the other. Russians are no longer satisfied with the trade-off, and Putin himself has become a prime target of their anger. One way or another, Putin will cling to power, said Daniel Treisman in CNN.com. He may try to mollify the opposition with a few liberal reforms, but the public was long ago inoculated against empty Kremlin promises. He could attempt to woo the masses with new spending, but the slowing economy and swelling state budget make that a risky strategy. He could even trade his soft authoritarianism for a tougher, more effective model. But whatever Putin does, Russia's turbulence is just beginning. The next item, cutbacks on mail delivery. The U.S. Postal Service announced this week that it would dramatically scale back services in a bid to save itself from bankruptcy. The Post Office said it would seek Congress's approval to eliminate next-day delivery for first-class mail and to slow down other mail service. Letters and postcards would take at least 2 days to deliver, and commercial mail, such as periodicals, up to 9 days. The U.S. Postal Service also wants to shut over half of the 487 mail processing centers starting in March and to eliminate around 28,000 jobs. The Postal Service lost $5.1 billion last year because of large pension obligations and rapidly shrinking postal volumes, and faces bankruptcy if it does not restructure and cut costs. You can't continue to run red ink and not make changes, said Patrick Donahue, the Postmaster General. The U.S. Postal Service is committing suicide by 1,000 cuts, said John Nichols in TheNation.com. Downgrading service will only hasten its demise, not save it. Cutting next-day delivery will push even more customers over to the Internet and presents private ruling party, and presents private companies with an open invitation to take away even more of the Postal Service's business. Americans are almost being pushed into the arms of UPS and FedEx. So why not let one of them just buy the U.S. Postal Service, said NationalReview.com in an editorial. A private owner could return the Postal Service to profitability by focusing exclusively on services that customers are willing to pay for and breaking up the labor unions whose insistence on unusually high salaries and benefits is bankrupting the service. There is no reason for the government to run a mail company. But as long as it does, said Maurice McTeague in NewYorkTimes.com, Congress needs to stand back and let the USPS make sound business decisions. Lawmakers have failed for years to grant the Postal Service the authority to make smarter moves, such as ending Saturday delivery, charging more for postage stamps, and opening branches in convenient locations like grocery stores, malls, and pharmacies. The USPS could still save itself, but only if it's allowed to act like a real business. Now in the Week magazine, we'll turn to the controversy of the week, entitled Romney No Longer the Inevitable Nominee. Don't look now, said John Avlon in the DailyBeast.com, but the presidential campaign of Willard Mitt Romney is fast becoming a sinking ship. With the first GOP primary less than a month away, Romney's poll numbers are suddenly plummeting in key states, while those of Newt Gingrich, the former House Speaker, and the race's new frontrunner are soaring. Gingrich now has a commanding double-digit lead in Iowa, South Carolina, and Florida, and is within 4 points in Romney's expected stronghold of New Hampshire. The Newt surge isn't about Newt Gingrich, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. It's about Mitt Romney and his failure to close the deal with conservative voters. He didn't help himself with last week's now famous interview on Fox News, in which he became peevish and agitated when asked to explain his shifting positions on his Massachusetts health care plan, immigration, and other issues. Despite the furious smile painted on his lips, Romney essentially refused to answer and acted as if he were a short-circuiting robot. Team Romney is aware of the Romney bot problem, said Robert Draper in the New York Times Magazine, but they're betting that in 2012, recession-weary voters want a fixer, not a BFF. Romney's immaculately groomed exterior, they say, masks a voracious intellect and a talent honed over 25 years in the business world for finding practical, successful solutions to real-world problems. Rather than try to make Romney something he's not, the plan is to present him to voters as exquisitely one-dimensional, a robot, yes, but a robot equipped with exactly the right attachments and software to fix the economy. Given Romney's success as a turnaround artist of struggling companies at Bain Capital, said Catherine Lopez in NationalReview.com, Romney is eminently qualified to clean up Barack Obama's mess and free the private sector to start hiring again. GOP voters don't want to nominate an efficient technocrat, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com. They're looking for someone who shares their visceral loathing of all that Obama represents, an America of cities, Yankees, swells, swillers of Pinot Noir, blacks, Hispanics, Muslims, and gays. As a tennis club corporate preppy, Romney can't convincingly give voice to conservatives' conviction that they're engaged in an apocalyptic battle over America's very soul. And please don't tell conservatives that the moderate Romney is more electable, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com. They were told the same thing when the GOP nominated centrists John McCain and Bob Dole, only to see them lose in the general election. They've seen his act before, and they know how it turned out. Oh, they'll come around, said Ramesh Ponnuru in National Review. It will soon become clear that Gingrich's incendiary, grandiose, and abrasive rhetoric and his ugly marital history would turn off independents. Romney, on the other hand, has developed a reassuring presidential mien. He's the GOP's best bet for unseating Obama. As for the fear that a President Romney would betray conservatives on taxes, abortion, and climate change, fear not. Congressional Republicans have moved solidly to the right, and Romney's too smart to go to war with the vast majority of his party. If Romney can prove his staying power in the rigors of a competitive primary, Republicans will take a deep breath and then nominate him. My bet is that's exactly what they're going to do. Now we'll turn to the popular column in the Week magazine called The Good Week For and The Bad Week For. Always entertaining. It was a good week for inflation after it was revealed that Medicare has spent $240 million over the last decade on penis pumps for recipients over 65 suffering from erectile dysfunction. It was a good week for Tiger Woods after he won the Chevron World Challenge by one shot, ending a losing streak that lasted since his extramarital affairs were exposed 2 years ago. It just feels awesome, Woods said, admitting he'd been struggling a bit. And it was a good week for changing teams after Occupy Wall Street protester Tracy Postert was hired by a Wall Street firm. At the protest, she held up a sign saying, PhD biomedical scientist seeking full-time employment, and was called in for an interview by a brokerage firm. She was hired as a junior analyst. It was a bad week for Michelle Bachmann, the fading GOP presidential candidate, after she vowed to close down the U.S. embassy in Iran. The U.S. hasn't had an embassy in Tehran since the 1980 hostage crisis. It was a bad week for Christmas magic after a man dressed as Santa Claus attempted to rappel from the ceiling at a Florida mall and got his beard caught in the rope. As a crowd of kids watched, a wriggling Santa finally got free by pulling off his beard, wig, and hat. And it was a bad week for Alec Baldwin after the famously hot-headed actor was kicked off an American Airlines flight for refusing to turn off his cell phone. The airline and witness said Baldwin became so infuriated that he locked himself in the bathroom, beat on the walls, and screamed so loud the pilot could hear him in the cockpit. Let's turn to the People's section in the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled Fassbender's Cinematic Love. Michael Fassbender isn't afraid to get intimate on screen, said Kyle Buchanan in New York. In recent movies, the German-Irish actor has bedded, spanked, and whipped Keira Knightley and romped with a bevy of burlesque starlets. The key to a good sex scene, he explains, is making your co-star feel comfortable. The most important thing to say is, let's talk about this, says the 34-year-old. You have to say, what lines do you have that you don't want me to cross? Do you mind if I touch your breasts? Can I kiss your breasts? Just so you know, I'm not taking advantage and taking anything out of the situation. Sometimes, he adds, alcohol can help loosen things up. You take a couple of shots of tequila and, you know, get groovy. Fassbender thinks that his parents would be proud of his recent explicit performances, particularly the full frontal nude shots in his movie Shame. Women parade around naked all the time in films, but the guy conveniently has his pants on, he says. I remember my mom complaining about that, saying, this is such bull. It's always the women who are naked. So I did this one for you, Mom. The next article, A Life Wrecked by Phone Hacking. Mary Ellen Field has never been famous, said Stuart Jeffries in the London Guardian. Yet thanks to the British tabloids, the 62-year-old accountant lost her job, reputation, and health. In 2003, Field was hired by Ellie McPherson to help develop her business interests. For 2 years, she says, they had tremendous fun. Then stories about the supermodel began appearing in the press, and suspicion fell on Field. McPherson accused her of being an alcoholic and leaking stories to the media. She demanded that Field attend a rehab clinic in Arizona. Ellie said, "I love you so much, we're doing this for you." Field denied everything, but felt she had to obey her employer. "I needed the job," she admits. "Rehab was awful. There were no plugs in the basin so you couldn't drown yourself. The staff was baffled by her presence. They said I wasn't an alcoholic, but I had clearly been bullied." After 5 weeks, she returned to London, only to be fired by McPherson. When the hacking scandal broke this spring, Field realized that tabloid journalists had stolen the model's secrets by tapping her phone. But it was too late. The stress had damaged Field's heart. She now has a pacemaker, and it took her years to rebuild her career. "My life was destroyed. The hackers are pigs for what they did to me." Now from the People's section in the week, Lady Gaga's bad romances. "Lady Gaga doubts she'll ever find real love," said Lisa Robinson in Vanity Fair. "I have never felt truly cherished by a lover," says the pop star. "I have an inability to know what happiness feels like with a man." The pressures of fame, she said, have caused some of her relationships to flatline. "When I fight with someone I'm in a relationship with, I think, what would my fans think if they knew this was happening," she says. "How would they feel about my work and me as a female if they knew I was allowing this to go on? And then I get out." She says other relationships soured when lovers grew jealous of her talent. "When I'm in these relationships with creative people, the attraction is there initially, and it's all unicorns and rainbows. Then they hate me. If I go to the piano and write a quick song, they are angry with how fast and effortless it is." After these relationships ended, several of the envious ex-boyfriends have asked Gaga to marry them. She thinks they're pathetic. "How romantic, you expletive. Sure, pop a ring on my finger and make it all better. I can buy it myself, a ring." Now from the People's section, we'll turn to the weekly feature briefing. This one is entitled, "All the Speech Money Can Buy. Super PACs are raising unlimited funds to sway the 2012 elections. How will that affect democracy?" Well, what are super PACs? Super PACs are a new supercharged breed of political action committees. That's what PAC means. Organizations that raise and spend money to elect and defeat candidates. While PACs have been around for decades, super PACs came into existence only recently as the result of a landmark Supreme Court case in 2010, Citizens United. In that bitterly contested 5-4 ruling, the court struck down part of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law, saying it infringed on the First Amendment rights of independent organizations, corporations, and unions to express opinions about elections. In fact, a federal appeals court ruled that year these entities can spend unlimited amounts of money on political speech. Super PACs sprang up to serve as conduits of this spending. In 2010, these organizations poured a total of $65.3 million into the congressional elections. That was just the start. For the 2012 elections, about 250 super PACs will spend from $600 million to $1 billion as Republicans and Democrats battle over the presidency and the future direction of the country. "The campaign finance story of 2010 was big money," says Republican campaign finance lawyer William McKinley. "The 2012 story will be even bigger money." Why do super PACs bring in so much money? Well, because they provide a way to circumvent campaign finance law. Individuals are still limited to giving $2,500 to any federal candidate, while PACs set up by corporations, unions, and other organizations are limited to $5,000 per candidate. But Citizens United effectively makes those limits moot. Individuals or organizations can write checks of any amount to a super PAC. The only limitation is that super PACs, as outside organizations, are not allowed to directly coordinate their efforts with a candidate's campaign. But that separation is largely cosmetic, and many super PACs appear to be virtual extensions of the campaigns. Mitt Romney's Restore Our Future PAC is run by his head lawyer in the 2008 campaign. A former press secretary for President Obama heads his Priorities USA group of super PACs. Who contributes to super PACs? Mostly rich people with strong partisan agendas. Jeffrey Katzenberg, the liberal DreamWorks CEO, has given $2 million to Priorities USA Action, a Democratic super PAC. The libertarian-minded Koch Brothers super PAC, Americans for Prosperity, has pledged to spend $200 million in 2012. In some cases, it's unknown who contributes to certain super PACs. Under federal rules, super PACs that set up an educational or charitable arm do not have to disclose the names of contributors. That loophole is now being widely exploited. Well, how do the super PACs spend their cash? The emphasis is on attack ads of every kind. Take, for example, the current political ads of a Democratic super PAC that calls itself Rethink, whose goal is to oust Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown. The $150,000 ad campaign portrays Brown as a heartless tool of corporations and Wall Street, who has voted to scuttle financial regulations and end unemployment checks to constituents. In response, Karl Rove's super PAC called Crossroads GPS is paying for $600,000 worth of ads that portray Brown's Democratic opponent, consumer crusader Elizabeth Warren, as an out-of-touch professor who favors the radical redistribution of wealth and is responsible for the violence and drug use at Occupy Wall Street protests. Is this what the Supreme Court wanted? In a sense, yes. The court's majority ruled that it is not the business of government to decide how much or what kind of political speech is appropriate, and that more speech ultimately means a more informed electorate. Corporations, the court said, have the same right to speech as any individual. Free speech advocates also argue that campaign finance laws, while well-intentioned, serve to protect incumbents who usually get the bulk of political contributions. Why not let everyone speak and let the public decide? Given the premises of democracy, Justin Antonin Scalia once wrote, there is no such thing as too much speech. How will super PACs affect democracy? There will certainly be more political speech than ever. As November 2012 approaches, no one will be able to turn on a TV without seeing a political ad featuring ominous music, unflattering photos of candidates, and alarming rhetoric. Super PAC ads tend to be the most negative of all because they aren't directly sponsored by candidates, so there is plausible deniability when the ads cross the line into deception and character assassination. That kind of ad may sometimes backfire, but in the long run, allowing deep-pocket contributors to write checks for unlimited amounts, sometimes anonymously, will inevitably add to the growing partisan bitterness in politics and give well-funded vested interests even greater influence. Craig Holman of Public Citizen, a good government advocacy group, said one Capitol Hill staffer explained the influence of super PACs to him this way. How do I say no to a corporate lobbyist with deep pockets, knowing that the corporate client can spend unlimited money to unseat my boss? And now the carve-out section here in this briefing is entitled The Dirtiest Super PAC Attack. Even in a country where attack ads are an art form, the ad produced by Turn Right USA against Democratic congressional candidate Janice Hahn of California may have set a new low standard. The ad, which never aired on TV but went viral on YouTube, superimposed Hahn's face on the body of a stripper and used black actors to portray gang members, while rap music played and images of criminals, including Charles Manson, floated by. Gangsters plucked dollar bills from the stripper's panties, singing, "Give us your cash, bitch." As a narrator said, that Han helped gang members get out of jail so they can rape and kill again. Han blamed her Republican opponent, wealthy Tea Partier Craig Huey, and his cronies for using a super PAC to create the ad. But Huey said he had nothing to do with it, and Turn Right said the ad was definitely not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. The ad may have created sympathy for Han, who cruised to an easy victory. In the final frames of the ad, which can be seen on YouTube, the super PAC got the last word. Suck it, McCain-Feingold. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for this week, December 16th, 2011. Thanks for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to the best columns in the U.S. section of the Week magazine. Our first column is entitled Our Country's True Job Creators by Nick Hanauer in Bloomberg.com. Rich people don't create jobs, said Nick Hanauer, and I should know. As a venture capitalist and entrepreneur, I've started and invested in dozens of manufacturing, retail, medical, and internet companies that have made me very rich. But I don't consider myself a job creator. No matter how many people I hire, my business will collapse and the jobs will disappear if consumers can't afford to buy what I'm selling. Our country's prosperity has always required a strong, vibrant middle class whose consumer hunger is the engine that creates wealth for everyone. Yet with the middle class now in dire straits, Republicans insist that if we raise taxes on the rich to help the middle class, job creation will stop. This is transparently false. In recent years, super-rich Americans and corporations have grown even wealthier, but all that wealth concentrated in few hands has created very few jobs. If we want our economy to recover, we need to give a break to the true job creators by raising taxes on the super-rich and putting more money in the wallets of the middle class. Capitalists without customers are out of business. The next column is entitled Facebook Users Should Give Up on Privacy by Farhad Manju in Slate.com. Mark Zuckerberg wants you to know that Facebook has reformed, said Farhad Manju. After a series of privacy violations and a Federal Trade Commission investigation, the social media boss last week admitted that his site had made a bunch of mistakes, and he promised to give users greater control over how they share information. But Facebook's privacy issues are as much our fault as Zuckerberg's. Too many users seem to believe they can control who gets to see the private thoughts and photos they post to a site with 800 million users throughout the world. Facebook was designed to be one of the most intrusive technologies ever built, a vehicle for sharing personal information. Upload a photo of your drunken antics and it's on the internet, stored on dozens of servers around the world. Marking that shot friends only won't prevent an online buddy from copying the picture and distributing it. So next time you're wondering about whether you should post something on Facebook, remember this simple rule. The only sure way to keep something private on Facebook is not to post it on Facebook. And the next column is entitled The Curious Hatred of Tim Tebow by Daniel Foster in NationalReview.com. Why does Tim Tebow irritate so many people? Asked Daniel Foster. Fans, sports writers, and other players openly mock the Denver Broncos quarterback for his outspoken expressions of evangelical Christian faith, which include a gesture now universally called Tebowing, sinking to one knee to pray with his head bowed. After sacking Tebow, a Detroit Lions linebacker even Tebowed on the field to show his disdain. What galls his critics, it seems, is that a pro athlete could be more earnest than a Boy Scout. There isn't an ironic bone in Tim Tebow's body. In an era in which other jocks father scores of illegitimate children, Tebow has publicly professed to be a virgin. When teammates go out to celebrate a win in bars and strip clubs, he goes home after a win to prepare for the next game. While other players squander their huge salaries on cars, mansions, and bling, Tebow selflessly devotes his spare time to missionary work in Thailand and spreading the word in schools, churches, and prisons. For worldly cynics, it's not just Tebow's God talk that is so annoying. What truly galls them is that he might actually believe it. Now from the Week magazine, we will flip to the back of the book here to the section that is called The Last Word. This week, the title of this particular section is From Dyslexia to Poetry. They laughed at my struggle to read, says Philip Schultz, but fighting back made me into a writer. This much is clear. The mind of a dyslexic is different from the minds of other people. Learning that my problem with processing language wasn't stupidity seemed to take most of my life. Like every other important trade-off in life, giving up this negative image of myself has been complicated and difficult. I'd grown accustomed to seeing myself as someone who, if fallible and unworthy, had nevertheless managed to do one thing well enough to get recognition for it. I'd learned to accommodate and live around my compromised self in a somewhat comfortable and acceptable manner. Since I was 10, I taught myself to live a life of opposites. Because I couldn't do this, I learned to enjoy doing that, a compensatory way of swimming against constantly shifting currents. It worked well enough. I was happily married, had two terrific boys, a career as a writer, and a private school, which I would soon come to understand, had been created out of the very thinking process I used to compensate for my dyslexia, all accomplishments of which I was very proud. The act of translating what for me are the mysterious symbols of communication into actual comprehension has always been a hardship to me. I often read a sentence two or three times before I truly understand it, must restructure its syntax and sound out its syllables before I can begin to absorb its meaning and move on to the next sentence. And when I make the mistake of becoming aware that I am reading and behaving in a way that enables this mysterious, electrically charged process to take place, my mind balks and goes blank, and I become anxious and stop. For reasons I'll never fully understand, or perhaps don't even want to, I dislike the peculiar, obstinate, slightly out-of-control way in which my mind behaves when I'm reading. I can never just sit down and begin reading. I must first trick myself into it by playing endless games of solitaire on my computer, or reheating my tea, or taking another walk with my dog Penelope. But once I'm actually reading, once I've convinced myself that it's in my best interest to engage in this struggle, I proceed haltingly at first, hesitating at the beginning of each new thought and sentence, as if accruing additional strength and courage. And while reading, I must sell myself a bill of goods, convince myself that what I'm reading is so fascinating and valuable, so compelling that it's worth the effort. I must remind myself at regular intervals that having to constantly reread sentences is both sensible and necessary, an act of self-discipline, fortitude, and concentration that ultimately will benefit me not only as a person, but as a writer. I often forget the meaning of words I've looked up many times before and must consult a dictionary, as I frequently consult a thesaurus while writing to make sure I've selected the right word. As I read, a kind of subtle bartering between uncertainty and hunger for knowledge goes on in my mind, in which I must conquer a feeling of hopelessness and anxiety. I've learned to read the way a runner learns to expect and find his second and third wins, the way an athlete pushes himself beyond where it is comfortable to go. I read word by word, sometimes congratulating myself on the completion of each sentence, each paragraph and chapter. Perhaps this is why it's particularly hard for me to read anything that isn't well written and moving. Why I became a poet, because poetry is so compressed and is often beautifully written and moving. All of which, without doubt, makes the fact of my being a writer even more strange and, to a degree, wonderfully preposterous. I remember the first time I even considered the idea of being a writer. I was in the fifth grade when my reading tutor, whom I had been forced to see after my parents were threatened with the possibility of yet another expulsion, asked me out of the blue what I thought I might like to do with my life. Without a moment's hesitation, I answered that I wanted to be a writer. My reading tutor was a retired grade school principal, a good-natured, slightly stern man who was so overweight that the opening in his desk couldn't accommodate the width of his belly, and he sat so far away from it he couldn't easily reach anything on his desktop. When he laughed, his belly moved in gelatinous waves all the way from his chin down to his knees, and now he was laughing, really laughing. What was so funny about a boy who couldn't read at the age of 11 saying he wanted to become someone who spends most of his time doing precisely that? The fact that I couldn't read didn't mean that I never would. I thought I was always assumed I would one day, and what difference would it then make? But Mr. Joyce, and only many years later did I appreciate the irony of his name, couldn't stop laughing. He kept wiping the tears from his eyes, apologizing, and then starting up again, laughing even harder this time. "Philip, my dear boy, why in the world do you imagine you want to do something for the rest of your life that has been so hard for you to do on the most basic level?" he asked, holding his belly as if to control further eruptions. I could only manage a small shrug. I had absolutely no idea why, and I wasn't insulted. I was just curious. "How long have you wanted to be a writer?" "Not very long," I ventured. "How long, then, since you asked me? I never thought about it before." Now he started laughing again with even greater force and enthusiasm. Later that night in bed, after I told my mother what I told Mr. Joyce and we were reading my Black Hawk comic books together, she would read the words aloud and I would imitate the sounds as if reading them myself. I surprised both of us by interrupting her and actually reading the words. I remember the way she sat there, staring at me, her eyes wide, as I read without pausing for breath, afraid if I stopped I would never be able to begin again. I sang each word, smiling, looking over her shoulder at the January moon, which I could see through my torn window shade, big and gaunt-looking, smiling down at me, it seemed, as if with wonder. It was the same wonder I felt as I remembered another January day 2 years earlier when my mother had been called to my previous school by my teacher and my school principal. My third grade teacher told my mother that I never followed instructions, paid attention, or obeyed the simplest directions. I left class when I pleased, and I got into fights with other boys, the principal told her. I rubbed a boy's face against a cement culvert in the playground the day before, cutting his cheek and mouth. What they didn't tell her is what this boy, along with other boys, had said to make me so angry. He said I was a dummy who couldn't learn anything. So I did what I saw my father and my uncle do when someone insulted them, what all the tough guys in all the movies and on TV did when insulted. I hit kids with my strength to make them stop laughing at me. The principal told my mother that he saw no other recourse than to expel me from school. As he spoke, my mother's eyes grew small and hard. She was trying not to cry. I thought because she didn't want him to see how much this was hurting her. But why didn't they tell her what those kids had done? They had mimicked my stuttering. Why weren't their mothers called to school? He looked and spoke only to her, as if I weren't there, standing next to her as if I were invisible. It was the way I felt in school, listening to the teacher talk only to the other children, as if she didn't think I would understand what she was saying, as if it was a waste of time talking to me. Since I couldn't be expected to begin my next school year at the fourth grade, the principal added, I was being held back a year. It was snowing as we walked home, but my mother didn't seem to notice the snow or that I was hurrying to keep up with her. She always held my hand, but not now. She was walking quickly, as if trying to get away from me. When she slipped on ice and fell into a slush puddle and just sat there looking up at me sighing, I wanted to keep on walking. My mother never lied to me. She told me what the big scar on her belly was because they had cut her open to pull me out so I could be born. She told me that I didn't have a brother or sister because she had lost a baby girl the year before I was born, and her doctor said it was too dangerous for her to give birth again. She wanted me so much she didn't care, she said. Each night while putting me to sleep, she'd tell me how much she loved me, that I was the best thing that ever happened to her, and that she wanted me to do well in school because she'd loved going to school, loved learning with all her heart, but that her Polish immigrant father made her leave school to help support their family. She told me how much she hated being uneducated and not knowing things everyone else knew. I would change all that for her, she said. I would do everything she couldn't do. I would make something out of myself. I would make her proud. And now I was being held back and kicked out of school and going to the worst school in upstate New York. I wasn't the one thing in her life that she'd done right. She sat there in the wet snow looking up at me. Anything was better than seeing her this way, I thought. Anything. And now I was reading, and my mother was smiling at me. Philip, she said, you're reading all by yourself. Yes, I said, I'm reading. Is it because you told Mr. Joyce you wanted to be a writer and he laughed at you? I didn't care if he laughed. But you're reading, Philip, like you always knew how. Yes, I thought like I always really knew how. And if you can read, you can write, I thought to myself. It was that simple. And that article is from the book My Dyslexia by Philip Schultz. It was reprinted here with the courtesy of W.W. Norton and Company, Inc. And now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the Talking Point section. Our first article today is entitled Terrorism: Locking Up Suspects Without Trials. Should the government have the power to lock up anyone it accuses of terrorism without charges or a trial? That Soviet-style justice may soon become a permanent part of the American way, said Andrew Rosenthal in NewYorkTimes.com. The Senate voted last week to require anyone suspected of plotting terrorist attacks against the U.S. on or off American soil to be detained indefinitely without trial by the military. The National Defense Authorization Act effectively takes the FBI and federal courts out of the picture and hands the business of interrogating, charging, and trying suspected terrorists over solely to the military. So much for the U.S. Constitution, said Spencer Ackerman in Wired.com. Even if accused terrorists are U.S. citizens or legal residents, the Senate bill, which now must be reconciled with a similar bill passed by the House, would abrogate the right to a fair trial until the end of hostilities. The hostilities in the war on terrorism, of course, will end the Wednesday after never. Critics of military detention forget that we are at war, said Adam Paul Laxalt and Ron DeSantis in NationalReview.com. The Islamic jihadists who wish to destroy the U.S. should be treated as enemy combatants, not criminal suspects, subject to domestic laws and constitutional rights. The civilian courts aren't designed to process terrorists detained during wartime and will surely end up releasing some of them on legal technicalities. The result? More dead Americans here and abroad. As for the rare U.S. citizen who betrays his country, said Andrew C. McCarthy, also in NationalReview.com, the courts have long permitted the president during wartime to treat traitors as enemies of the state. During the Civil War, President Lincoln did not give captured Confederate soldiers trials. He locked them up until the war was over. The bill's apologists are acting as if the smoke were still rising from the ruins of the fallen World Trade Center towers, said the Philadelphia Inquirer in an editorial. But 9/11 was over a decade ago. Osama bin Laden is dead. Al-Qaeda's leadership is in tatters, and soldiers are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. Surely now is the time to return to the human rights standards we gave up after 9/11, rather than write our excesses into law. President Obama has threatened to veto this bill, and he must, even amid the threat from Al-Qaeda. Core freedoms must prevail. The next item from the Talking Points section, Kane, the lessons of an unusual campaign. The Herman Kane train has come to the end of the line, said Kimberly Strassel in the Wall Street Journal. The Republican presidential candidate suspended his campaign indefinitely last week after a torrent of accusations from women about sexual harassment and a 13-year extramarital affair. Kane's personal shortcomings aside, his candidacy has provided a telling glimpse of what conservatives really want in a presidential candidate: energy and genuine enthusiasm. The former Godfather's Pizza chief executive transformed a dull, negative campaign focused on criticism of President Obama with his positive, forward-looking message about restoring America's economic health. With his inspirational rhetoric and easy humor, said Mark Caputo in the Miami Herald, Kane gave voters a reason to vote for someone rather than just against someone. Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich should take note. The only thing Kane demonstrated, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com, is that the system worked. Thanks to the intense scrutiny that presidential candidates receive, Kane was revealed to be an unsavory character of astounding ignorance. His 999 tax plan was simplistic and unworkable. He admitted knowing nothing about foreign affairs. He couldn't even decide whether he was pro-life or pro-choice. It's a small victory for rationality that most Republicans finally figured out that he was unelectable. That he got so far doesn't say much for Republicans, said Michael Tomosky in thedailybeast.com. All politicians have big egos, but Kane is a man of astonishing narcissism who thought he could become president through the strength of a silly 999 slogan, some Republican dogma, and his own personality. Don't underestimate Kane's impact, said Beth Reinhardt and Alex Rorty in theatlantic.com. He may have permanently changed the way candidates run for president. Kane had only a bare-bones campaign organization and ignored the heavy-on-shoe-leather slog of personally wooing voters in primary states. Instead, he shot to the top of the polls on the strength of his charismatic debate performances and cable TV interviews. The other candidates have followed suit and focused on building national support. Spending on political advertising in Iowa and New Hampshire has fallen by 75% compared with 2008. Herman Kane didn't make it to the White House, but the trail he blazed will remain. Our next item is entitled, Work, Life Without Email? Is email obsolete? Asked Steven Rosenbaum in FastCompany.com. Atos, Europe's largest IT firm, thinks so. The company last week announced that it was banning internal email, as CEO Thierry Breton thinks that 90% of messages sent between employees are a waste of time. Instead, Breton wants his 74,000 staff members to talk to one another in real, in person, or on the phone, and switch to real-time messaging tools like Facebook. It looks as if other companies will soon follow suit. By 2014, a technology research group has predicted social networking will replace email as the main method of communication for 20% of businesses. Good riddance, said William Powers in the New York Times. Email was supposed to boost productivity, but it has done the opposite. When a worker sends an office-wide message about a broken vending machine, everyone stops work to read a pointless bit of trivia. Studies show that such inbox clogging interruptions can cost a 1,000-employee company up to $10 million a year. Dumping email won't fix those technical problems, said Peter Bright in ArsTechnica.com. Whenever office workers are interrupted, whether by an email, a phone call, or simply a coworker stopping by their desk for a chat, it typically takes them 15 minutes to regain their focus and get back to work, studies have shown. So while 90% of Atos's internal email might be worthless, ditching it entirely doesn't mean that employees will end their unproductive communication. In fact, life without email could be far worse, said Richie Jennings in ComputerWorld.com. By fixing a successful and efficient communication tool, or by nixing it, I should say, Breton will force employees to hold more time-consuming phone conferences and face-to-face meetings. But like it or not, electronic mail is slowly wheezing toward the grave, said Dominique Jackson in the London Mail. The younger generation has all but given up on it. Visits to email sites by 12 to 17-year-olds fell 18% in 2010, and digitally savvy teens now communicate almost entirely via social networks and instant messenger services. These chat-type systems have the advantage of immediacy over the disjointed timeline of an email exchange. Messages do not sit for hours in somebody's inbox. In fact, instant chatting can almost feel like you're having a real face-to-face conversation with a coworker. Remember what that was like? Now, a couple of quick items as we reach the end of the program. Carbon dioxide emissions around the world last year jumped by the largest amount on record, increasing by 500 million tons. The 5.9% rise was the largest since 2003. And now the poll watch for this week. If Ron Paul ran for president as a third-party candidate, 16% of all voters say it is very or somewhat likely they'd vote for him. 9% say the same about New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. And for many Americans, the holidays are not an entirely joyous time. Among the things people dread, waiting in lines and crowds, 68%, putting on weight, 37%, getting into debt, 37%, seeing relatives, 24%, and attending holiday parties. That was from a Consumer Reports survey. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We certainly hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long, till next time.